The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the June 17th, 2013 edition of The Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm really looking forward to my topics for discussion tonight. I know that the picture I included in today's mailer was gross, but I wanted to illustrate something that and this was what I thought was most important to illustrate for a couple of reasons. I would like to have a bunch of illustrations for tonight, but I will refer you to the pages where you can see them. I probably won't get into that Jeff Bauman until the second hour, though. So I'll also be taking phone calls in the second hour at 1-830-443-4911. That's not, though, until after the break, after we come back from the break. By way of introducing tonight's show, and I've got five topics that I've got numbered here that I want to go into. I want to say that this is a little bit of a continuation, maybe, or follow-up from the show, the Heretics Hour show I did 2 weeks ago on the historical importance in Holocaust revisionism, something like that. There's just more to say. There's a lot I have to say about that, but I'm illustrating it with the number of items tonight. And it's, for me, as I see it today, it's not just a matter of truth, but it's a matter of power over truth. Truth can never get out if the powers that be don't want it to. Sure, sometimes truth gets out. It does. It can be countered, you know, and there are many avenues to stop it. And if it does get out, they do their best. It can be that which is powerful does its best to compromise it, to misrepresent it, to turn people's attention away from it, and so on. So it's a battle. It's probably always been a battle, but it's what has changed, as in everything in our whole entire history on this earth, is the technology has changed. Not much has changed, really, but the technology, the way that things are carried out, has continued to change, and we are in a time now of what we consider to be very high technology. Of course, I guess it can get higher. Kind of scary to even think about that, but we consider this pretty darn high-tech times we're living in. And money comes from power. If you don't have the power, you won't get the money. People often put the money first, and power comes from money. But, you know, they feed off each other until one really can't say which came first, like with the chicken and the egg. But I would say that power comes first. Now, I want to talk first about a story that has been in the news some, and that tomorrow President Barack Obama will show up in Berlin. This will be June 18th and 19th also he'll be there. And they're going all out in Berlin and in Germany to put up this incredible security for this man. They've got a story that says that, you know, they're sealing manhole covers, they're closing streets, and they're putting snipers on the rooftops. This is the highest level of security that they have in Germany, you know, has some kind of a number. And that's what they're bringing out for President of the United States, Barack Obama, and his families to make them, you know, totally safe. I mean, I can't imagine. Well, I guess I can. But they don't want anything to happen, you know, while he's in Germany. I was, the last time he was in Germany, he was in Dresden, and I was there on that day that he came to Dresden. I was in Dresden then. That was June 5th, 2009. And, he wasn't, this is his first visit to Berlin as president. That's why they call it the first. He was there as president in Dresden and made a side trip to Buchenwald in 2009. And then he was there as a presidential candidate, they say 5 years ago. I guess, yeah. So, but now they're making a big deal out of this. And it's naturally, you know, everything to do with Obama irritates me a great deal. Because, you know, he goes there, he's like this huge potentate. And the German, it just shows how he controls and owns the German nation, in a sense. You know, and the Germans have to go, they go all out for anything about a president of the United States. And the people have always had this positive feeling or friendly feeling toward the United States and toward Americans, in spite of all that America did to Germany. They're plenty brainwashed, but they have always had this great liking for Obama, when he was a candidate and was becoming, you know, known in politics. They just love him there. And when I was there in 2009 and I got to Dresden and I found out that he was, that the old town, you know, the tourist area, which I was so much looking forward to seeing, was going to be closed the next day and the day after that to everyone, because he was going to be walking through there to see the Frauenkirche, Church of Our Lady, that famous one that was destroyed and only got rebuilt fairly recently from the terrible bombing of Dresden. And I was shocked because I didn't know that. I had not seen anything about it, you know, and I didn't realize it. And the second day afterward, as soon as he was gone, they removed the fences and let people come in to the area. But all the security measures were still there. And I remember, particularly the sealed manhole covers, which were, I've talked about them before, but this stay in my mind. They had this bright yellow. It looked like a big, real wide plastic tape. You know, I mean, it was almost as wide as the manhole cover. And then they put one and they cross it with another one. And it looked like you could, you know, peel it up or something. I remember, and they were on all over the streets, because there's a lot of manholes, and there must be thousands and thousands of them. I wonder how many there are in the Berlin area where they're doing this. And all of the work, I mean, they spend millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. Somebody told me when I was there the amount of millions that it was costing Germany for this visit, this 2009 visit. And this one is probably much higher, because he's in Berlin, and I'm gonna go over that in a second here, all that they're doing there. But these manhole covers that they seal, I don't know how they get that up. Obviously, they have something to loosen the adhesive, but it's like steel. You know, it feels like a plastic, but because I reached down, you know, I tried to pick at one corner of one of them, and that didn't make that couldn't get even the slightest little anything picked away there. I mean, it's not pickable, this stuff. And it's very, just turned you off. They still had all these fencing that they had put all around the area, piled up here and there, and there's lots of security cars and police cars and all this stuff still going on in there. It really took away a lot. But they don't care, you know, when he comes, heck with the tourists. And when I think about tourists who have made their trip already and are in Berlin, and now he's coming to ruin it all. Now, some of them will say, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, maybe I'll get a picture of him. When I was there, I went into the town of Dresden that morning. I was in Dresden, but I was out kind of in the outskirts where I was staying. And I went and got off the train there, subway thing, and went out to the area where I was going to go to another town to spend the day there. And then there was a crowd there, so I thought I'd stand there with it for a while because I thought, well, this must be where they can see him. Maybe I should get a picture to show that I was here, you know, when he was here. Well, after standing there in this group, a big group of Germans for quite a while, finally I found out from some of them that they didn't know if he was going to be coming by there or not. They just hoped he might, and they would get a glimpse of this creepy guy. And so they were standing there waiting for that, and I don't believe they ever got any glimpse of him. From where we were looking in toward the area where the church is, there was a big stand that had been set up for something. I don't even think he spoke from that stand. Some other people did. I don't know. You know, but these Germans, I usually stand up for Germans, but I get pretty disgusted when I realize how gaga they go over Barack Obama. Anyway, let me see what I haven't said. He's going to be speaking in front of the Brandenburg Gate, as Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan did, to a crowd of several thousand invited guests. So I guess they're going to have a stands there, and they're going to have people, you know, who have tickets and can go and sit and so on and listen, and then the other people will be wherever they can be. But here, listen to this. The square facing the Brandenburg Gate, the Pariserplatz, will be closed to normal traffic for an entire week, beginning on Friday. That was, today's Monday, that was last Friday. Because they're setting all this stuff up and nobody can come in there. And Berlin will be under the highest security level, 1+, which I already told you involves snipers on rooftops, sealed off manhole covers, bomb sniffing dogs, numerous street closures and larger security zones. I imagine that's what they had also in 2009, but it was, like I say, it wasn't in the capital. And so, now, also, at the Brandenburg Gate, all doors and windows that are facing the square, that face the square where he's going to be giving his speech, will be closed, and no one will be allowed on balconies or terraces. So that, you know, the security's already been in there telling these people who live around there and so on that, you know, that maybe they've already locked their doors up and tell them they better not stick their face out there. Well, they've got snipers to shoot people who don't do things, follow the rules. And it says that this type of security on other occasions has involved divers searching the Spree River, which runs through the center of Berlin, and the airspace over Berlin has been closed. So this is what's done today. And I think about Adolf Hitler back in his time and how he went out and about among the German people and went out and gave speeches all over the place. And nothing like that. He had a bodyguard, you know, he probably had a few people. But nothing like this was going on, and it didn't need to be. But it does now for these wonderful democratic leaders that we have who are bringing freedom to us all. You know, they have to be protected as though they were a high, as they were, I guess, Satan himself, who the people would want to attack. So they've also hired thousands of additional police. That's why the cost gets so high. And says the first family will be staying at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Now, that means the whole family's going, I guess, and not just a wife, but the girls, too. Probably going to go and do some shopping with Mama. Get a lot of attention on that. And they're staying at the, I just told you, the Ritz-Carlton, which is on the Potsdamer Platz. So close to the Brandenburg Gate. So that will start tomorrow. And thank God, I imagine a lot of people will be glad when it's over because it really interferes with their activities, but mostly it interferes with tourists who are not able to take advantage of the things that they thought they would be able to. And they may have planned their trip, you know, weeks ago, months ago, and it wasn't something that they were going to change or could change. Anyway, enough for that. As well, I'm on Germany. I want to bring up a little bit about the NSU trial testimony, the National Socialist Union. I'm really not going to go into the trial testimony. I've been trying to follow that and cover that on my website, carolynyager.net. And the best information I've been able to get is actually from Spiegel International in English, because when I look for other things, you know, in German and then try to translate, it's so botched up and it's not very, it's just so botched up and hard to follow. And so I can't really follow every little in and out, but just follow the main things that happen. And it's going very slowly. There's not that much happening, but there is this, Carson S., which I already had in an article on my website, but, there was another, the day after that, that he did a little more testifying. He is the one, he is their best, he is the best they have. He is supposed to be an ex-neo-Nazi who gave it up like around 2000 already or end of the 1999 or something, I don't know. But, you know, he left the whole thing, supposedly. But he knew these two guys, the two Uis and Beta, and he is supposedly the one, he says he is, that bought the gun, that they said they needed a gun. And of course the question is whether they needed the gun for self-defense or for to go out and kill people. He has testified that they did not ask for a silencer with the gun. They wanted a German-made gun, a certain kind of gun. But when he went and looked for one, the one that he found available that he could buy for them came with a silencer. So he gave them a gun with a silencer, but they had not asked for it. So that's they spin that, but that should be taken into consideration. But he said something kind of interesting, because he was saying that he's been scouring his mind and memory, trying to remember everything. And it was a long time ago, so he doesn't remember it all that well, but he's decided he needs to just tell everything he knows, you know, spill everything. So he said that he was that he recalled that they had a meeting. He met these two men, these two boys, the two Uis, in a restaurant in a department store. And the three of them were sitting there and talking. And then I said, well, I was thinking, why would they, you know, department store restaurants are notoriously expensive. Why would they be there? But maybe they went there because it would be, you know, a crowded place where they wouldn't be seen by anybody, you know, that could be. So they were in this department store restaurant, and one of the guys told him that, just mentioned casually that they had left a flashlight in the department store somewhere. And he didn't really understand it. And just since he's been trying to remember things, he remembered that. And he thought that maybe the flashlight meant an explosive device. And they are able to say that there was a report on the day that he says he was there with them of an explosion in that department store. But it was very small, and nobody was hurt, and nothing was, you know, much. It was only in the local paper, a little mention of it, and there's no big thing. So he doesn't know that they're trying to make a lot about that to make them guilty of another crime. However, he also said that as they were sitting there, Beta Chiappa came up to meet them there, and as she was walking up and to them, they said to him, shh, don't say anything about this, so that she doesn't know. So that was like, you know, gave some testimony that she was unaware of everything that they were doing. I don't think much of this means much. I just think it's just a big show trial. And this guy came out with this And he had not said these things to the prosecutors, and the judge was a little concerned. He said, well, how come I haven't read anything about this yet, you know, before? And that's when this Carson said, well, he had just been trying to remember things. But I don't know if it did the prosecution much good. So, you can't necessarily from that connect these guys saying they left a flashlight there, or they could have left it there, forgotten it or something. And some little explosion that took place, but you know, you can't prove that. So it's kind of weird. That's the last, and it's still the last that they've talked about. Well, what I want to go into now is, to pick up again, somewhat on this thing with, James Fetzer and his radio program, my radio program and so on, because when I did that program 2 weeks ago, How Politics Affects Revisionism, that was the title of it. And then this past Saturday, I brought it up, again. And, well, I brought it up for the first time since I heard Jim Fetzer's program on June 5th at his Real Deal program. And, but I had, Jim and Joe Rizzoli on, and I left out a lot. In fact, I was feeling a little, conflicted about even talking about it, and that's why I didn't do the best job, although I did push it along. But I want to answer a couple more things about this, and then it's going to lead into something else. And that is that one thing, let's see if there's something ahead of this. Well, I would like to bring up something about Kevin Barrett first. That I totally forgot to mention too, when I was giving my story about how he had me on his show and he insisted we only have 1 hour when I thought we needed 2 hours to really talk about the subject, which was supposed to be about Adolf Hitler. But what I forgot about this part, which really surprised me, and I thought, didn't think much of it, didn't think too highly of it, after my hour was over, and I didn't, well, I did know because I saw it advertised, but I didn't know until right before the show, maybe that day or so, that he had invited Gordon Duff to be on the second hour after me. You know, he had his 2 hour program on, American Freedom Network. Then I think he still has one, he still has it there. And sometimes he has two guests. So, but without telling me, He was bringing on Gordon Duff after my hour with him, which I told you, I already spoke about how that went. And he obviously thought that he would give Gordon Duff the opportunity to tear into whatever I might say about Hitler or whatever. But you know, Duff, not wanting to tangle either with me or mostly with the Hitler story, because he doesn't know anything and doesn't know what he's talking about. When he got him on, Barrett says, "Well, what did you think about the first hour? You got anything to say about that?" And he said, "Well," he told Barrett, "he hadn't listened to it. He didn't listen to it." I think Barrett, I know Barrett expected him to listen to it, but he didn't listen to it. He said something about he was too busy. But, you know, and he talked about something totally differently. I thought that was such a riot because he did not want to go into any of that. So much for Kevin Barrett's plan there. Anyway, back to Jim Fetzer. You know, I was notified that he had a program and had some guests on it, and they talked pretty badly about me. Well, I expect that when I say critical things about people, they're gonna reciprocate often. So, but I did listen to it, and I was surprised that I wasn't surprised, but I did find that it went. The things that were said about me did not fit really the truth of, they didn't fit what could have been said, you know, if they would have rebutted things that I said, but they didn't do that. And, I've talked some about it, so I'm only going to bring up a few points that I have left out. And, that is that Fetzer kept, one thing I forgot to mention is that Fetzer kept saying that I did not listen to that radio program of Kevin Barrett's when he had Fetzer on about the very program, that I had been criticizing. I was criticizing Barrett's promotion of that program, but I never talked about the program itself. And so Fetzer kept saying, well, I didn't listen to it, and I don't know what I'm talking about. And he also kept saying that I didn't read his article on anti-Semitism that he had recommended everybody to read and that he was talking about on that program. So what did I know? I didn't know what I was talking about. I hadn't even listened or read, blah, blah. He went on about that over and over again. But, you know, I did listen to that program, and I listened to it before my program, and I did read his article. I read several of his articles that, you know, I wouldn't get on there and talk about it if I didn't. So I never said I did not, but because I didn't go into any details about it, which is what he would have wanted, he kept accusing me of not reading. But the fact is that on his program, he did talk about, I just moved my eyes around and lost my place here. He did talk about, he did mention things about me that he didn't know, and he didn't know what he was talking about. I mean, he didn't look at the things that I have done. He only picked up a few things from that program about himself, and then went from there and had his guests, come up with things. Well, I will just go on now with some of his, some of the comments about his program that I found. I decided to look it up and the other day, and I found that there are a lot of comments, a whole bunch of comments to this program that he did with Pasquale De Fabrizio and Mark Ellis on June 5th. But most of the comments were kind of pointless, and the people started arguing among themselves. But I found a few of them pretty good from my perspective. So I've got them copied down here. I'm going to go through them. And I do want to mention that I kept calling Pasquale De Fabrizio Pasquale. And I know his name is pronounced Pasquale, but I've somehow on that program Saturday, every time I said Pasquale. I don't know. I didn't think I was even doing that, but I was. So there you go. I don't always hear myself. Anyway, the first letter, and I have some things to say about it. Now, I thought about using this picture of Pasquale for my mailer because, wow, you know, he does have his picture on Fetzer's 9/11 Scholars for Truth. He has his page there as one of the members, and he looks just like a convict. Now, I've never seen a more brutish looking. I haven't say I've never seen. Of course I have. But he has really a rather crude looking face. And I think he had his sunglasses on. The picture was taken in a car or something. But he looks like a member of the mafia. He looks like one of the hitmen or something. He really does. But his voice doesn't sound that way. His voice is pretty nice. But his face, wow. Anyway, on these comments, he didn't come off very well. Nobody liked him very much. He had one guy supporting him. But the first one that I liked, and it might have been the very first comment, I think, was by somebody named Andy Time. And he said, it's one thing to point out the impossible. Now, this has to do with my ideas about revisionism and politics, okay? That's why this is important. This Andy Time writes, it's one thing to point out the impossible size and logistical details of the official and obviously exaggerated Holocaust narrative. It's clearly something very different to champion the Nazis' ghastly social experiment and to paint Hitler in his inner circle of totalitarian war criminals as merely a misunderstood and slandered group of humanitarians. Methinks the loudest, highest profile characters who fall into the second category are actually shills for the Zionists, busily working to discredit and criminalize, where possible, the work of courageous scholars who fit the first category. See, well, now this is exactly what I've been saying, that this is a very common attitude of people who will probably, for the first time, they probably haven't, but they're starting to accept that the Holocaust, as it's given, is exaggerated, that the narrative is exaggerated. But that's as far as they want to go. It's too many. 6 million is wrong, and the gas chambers are probably not quite right, and so on. They're willing to do that. They know it needs to be done, but they then though are worried about those who would somehow rehabilitate the National Socialists and Hitler in this process. And then he goes on in his third paragraph to say that those who are in that second class who would want to champion the Nazis are shills. They would have to be shills for the Zionists. See how they put that together. National Socialists are shills for the Zionists. That's like, Kevin Barrett, as I said in their program 2 weeks ago, calling NPR, National Public Radio, which is probably what you could call a Zionist radio network, call it National Socialist Public Radio, thinking that somehow is the same as that's, you know, which to me, I talked about that that's just, that's so ridiculous. But he says that in all seriousness. And that people who would come even close to any championing of the Nazis are working to discredit the work of the courageous scholars, that is the real revisionists, see, the good revisionists. This is what I've been talking about. And I come upon this a lot, and it stands out to me. I connect the dots with this. So that's the first letter. And here I want to stick in, I want to leave the letters from Fitzer's blog, and I want to stick in something else to do with revisionism. And in the second half, I've got some material about Elie Wiesel I want to talk about, so I want you to know that. I have a lot of good stuff coming up. So, but this Richard Widman is a good man. He's associated with CODO and Bradley Smith and all that, and has been for many years. And he's been a revisionist. He's written. He's a lot of things. He's kind of moderate. I had a very good, congenial, email exchange with him over something to do with, Elie Wiesel Kanza World. And, he was very, very helpful, very nice. He's polite. You know, he's all those good things like Bradley is. And I have nothing at all bad to say about him, except that he is, I can't say for sure, but I think he maybe even said, I don't know, but I think he's a libertarian. That's his way of thinking. He would think that you just judge people as individuals, and he wouldn't go for this mass accusations against the Jews, even though he has to be totally aware of how what the Jews are involved in and what they're up to with Holocaust. He knows what the Holocaust is, but still, you know, this is again where I say the politics comes into it. So he has been posting some things on Inconvenient History Revisionist blog, which is different from the Inconvenient History Journal that he is the senior editor of and main driving force of. But there's also the blog that is pretty much under the supervision of Thomas Cuse, and he does most of the work there and posting things and so on. You know, you send things to him and he posts them and so on. And I had some things posted there, but I haven't sent anything in there for a long time. So they haven't had too much there. Wilf Hank has done some good stuff there, but he sometimes doesn't do any work for a period of time. So Richard Widman has kind of come in on it, and he's been posting some things. But he has, like I say, this very moderate kind of way of writing about things. And so he has posted this blog, this short article about Rosenberg's diary there. And It's okay. I've got it all here. I don't want to read the whole thing. You know, they've just had this. The news now is that Alfred Rosenberg's diary, which they had at Nuremberg, and then it got lost, and it's been found. It's been discovered by Homeland Security. Our Homeland Security Department and Simon Wiesenthal Center is what I read, although he's got here U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Well, they got them involved in it. That's a part of Homeland Security to find out, you know, to look for this, and they discovered who had it. Well, it was this Kempner who stole the thing, but I won't go into that. Anyway, he writes about it. You know, it's just, but okay. Let's see if I have time to say this. I think he gives some quotes that are attributed to Rosenberg by this Nuremberg psychiatrist, G.M. Gilbert, who published all these. You know, I thought if you were a psychiatrist and you were, you know, having talks, you're doing your psychiatric work with people, even if they're prisoners, you know, that was confidential. But he had access to all these so-called German war criminals like Rosenberg and Göring and the whole group there. And if they were willing to talk to him, you know, I don't know if they could be, they couldn't be forced to talk to him, but if they were willing to talk to him, and they did, and he kept a record of it all. And afterwards, he published it in this book called Nuremberg Diary, everything that they had told him. And he recorded about Rosenberg you see, a lot of these men, you know, well, all of them, they didn't know anything about. They knew nothing about gas chambers or all this mass murder and so on. So when they were after they were arrested, they were told about this, and now they are in custody, and they had no access to find out otherwise or anything. And they were given all this information and pictures and so on. It was probably pretty convincing. And also, when you're in custody, you're pretty much at a disadvantage for going against the people who are in charge of you. So he got, you know, this is what would have happened with Rosenberg. They would have presented all this to him and see what your government did, see what your hero Hitler did, see what happened here. And so Rosenberg's response, according to this Gilbert, was, here's one quote, "Of course it's terrible, incomprehensible, the whole business. I would never have dreamed it would take such a turn. I don't know. Terrible." Now, these are selective quotes, so you don't know what else he said. He might have been saying, well, I don't know whether this is true or not. I don't think he would have done this or something. But anyway, another part of the interview, he has Rosenberg saying, "I don't know. I guess it just ran away with him," meaning Hitler. "We didn't contemplate killing anybody in the beginning. I can assure you of that. I always advocated a peaceful solution." And he goes on like that, and, you know, he said, "We just wanted to get we just wanted to take Jews out of their influential positions. That's all. Like, instead of having 90% of the doctors in Berlin Jewish, reducing them to 30% or something like that, which would have been a liberal quota even then. I had no idea that it would lead to such horrible things as mass murder. We only wanted to solve the Jewish problem peacefully. We even let 50,000 Jewish intellectuals get across the border." And talking about Lebensraum, Rosenberg is quoted as saying, "Well, I knew they were being transported to the East and understood that they were being set up in camps with their own administration and eventually would settle somewhere in the East. I don't know. I had no idea that it would lead to extermination in any literal sense. We just wanted to take them out of German political life." Well, in spite of all that, they found Rosenberg guilty on all four counts of the indictment, and he was one of, you know, amongst the many who were hung. He did nothing that he should have been hung for, but he was. And I suppose that Richard Widman, in putting in these quotes here, thinks that he is giving some good information that is, you know, exculpates to some degree some of these National Socialists, because he's saying what the plan was, and it wasn't murdering people, which we all know to be true. but except for those who don't know it. But he ends up then after that saying that for the sake of truth, Richard Widmann says, I advocate the immediate publication of Rosenberg's diaries in the original German language on the internet. Let's let the world see what was really written and let the chips fall where they may. Which is all fine, yeah, it should be, but it won't be because it's somehow the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum is being given this book because they say they played some role. Yeah, it wasn't the Simon Wiesenthal Center. I'm sorry, I got there. He's involved somewhere else. It was the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum that was working with the Homeland Security Department and their Immigration and Customs Enforcement Section, ICE. That's what it was. That's even worse. I mean, that's what's so awful. The Holocaust Museum was involved in this, and they have taken the book for their own. Yeah, the diary, supposedly they think it belongs to them, and I suppose they'll be allowed to have it. So they will do with it as they want. But then Widmann ends up by saying, I, for one, expect that an honest inquiry will lead to the rightful revision of this dark time in our recent history. And this, again, is not bad or anything, but I hate using, the phrase, this dark time. It can be interpreted differently. It can be interpreted as, well, this was a terrible time, and the war was terrible, and so many people were killed, and there was so much lying going on, and there, you know, it can be taken in any way, but mostly people would take it as, you know, the National Socialist regime was a dark time. I'm not saying he even thinks this, or that not everybody would take it this way, but I think this, I mean, I would just write this differently. I wouldn't write it this way. So that it just wouldn't. And then after that, he says for additional reading, and he recommends this book by Gilbert, Nuremberg Diary. Whereas I think this book is should not be recommended because this Gilbert, well, he's British, but he's a Jew, he's Jewish. And he's done all kinds of pro-Holocaust writings and recommending pro-Holocaust writings by others. He's terrifically involved in all of that. So he's not impartial at all. And I can't, I don't think that this book should just be recommended without any further explanation about it either. So this is an example for this person that I already read his comment, Andy Time, of courageous scholars, who want to point out the impossible size and details of the exaggerated Holocaust, but don't in any way champion the Nazis. Well, you don't even have to champion them. You have to. What he means is they don't. They don't condemn it. If you don't condemn the Nazis, you're championing them. So this is the kind of revisionist that they want, who's not going to go too strongly. And again, it's what's behind the different types of revisionists is politics, is your political views. That's what I'm trying to say here. So then we have another comment here at Jim Fetzer's radio blog here on Jim Fetzer's June 5th radio program. And this guy says, who is this guy DeFabrizio? He works in a factory or something, making ice cream? Is that it? Then he says uses some effing words, and he goes, but he doesn't like this Fabrizio. And then, so Fabrizio answers Pasquale. He writes a lot of comments here. And this is the kind of comment that all his comments were. He says, Brett, that's an interesting bunch of rambling there. First of all, I'm not a cop, but I am licensed private investigator in California. Well, I told you on Saturday, Saturday's show with Jim and Joe, about this, about him, and that he was introduced by Fetzer as a private investigator for insurance companies, for insurance company fraud. He says, if you don't know, so Pasquale says, if you don't know the difference between law enforcement and private investigators, I suggest you research it thoroughly before you throw around your lies in capital letters. Also, Brett, you demonstrated for everyone here your astounding lack of actual thought. You don't even know what you're writing in Italian, you know, you're writing your Italian incorrectly and so on. And then he ends up saying, you sound like another Zionist troll, Brett. And this is what he calls, this is what he called me. And this is what he calls everybody who doesn't agree with him and says something a little different. He calls all of the people who are opposed to him Zionist trolls or something like that. He called me a Zionist plant, working for Israel and so on. So then Kenny writes to him. He says Pasquale, he says, you're a private investigator? Yeah, right. You couldn't find the couch in your own front room, Sherlock. And so Pasquale answers him. And he says, are you calling me a liar, Kenny? I really am a private investigator in California. And he gives his license number. Says, you can look me up on the California State website. That's how smart you are, Kenny. You could easily have searched for me by name and verified if I am or am not a PI. So I know that you're definitely not a PI or a researcher of any kind. You sound like a Hasbara troll, a Zionist troll. Well, I looked up this man. I had Googled his name before, and all I came up with under that name was the Shoemaker for the Stars, who has this exact same name and has a business very successful in shoes, making shoes, and he has made a lot of the shoes for some big motion pictures, you know, and big stars and so on. He's got all that on his website. And I didn't come up with this guy at all. But when I Googled Pasquale De Fabrizio and Jim Fetzer together, then I came up with him on Jim Fetzer's shows, the few shows he's been on and on the blog and stuff. So yesterday I looked up California, you know, California private investigators, and I looked up California yellow pages and all this stuff, and they had private investigators there, whole bunch of them, not him. So how would anybody find him? Here he's giving his number, but now maybe you can go to what, California State website? I don't know. And find his license, him with his, I doubt it. So he's making he's right here. He's kind of not being straight, because if you look for him as an investigator, you don't find it. But he repeats twice that this Kenny is a Hasbara troll. And then he says, it's the same old song and dance with you Zio trolls, isn't it? You don't like what people like Fetzer and I say, so you start to attack our character and tell lies. You're a disgrace, Kenny. Well, this is similar to what Gordon Duff and Jim W. Dean do over there at Veterans Today. They love to call people Zionists. They're Zionists. This guy uses the word troll. Or they can use, you know, Zionist agents or various things like that, working for the Israelis and so on. I guess that's what they mean. What they're referring to is a Hasbara person, you know, who's working in that Hasbara program. But this is the only response they give, and it's ridiculous. So they become ridiculous. And everybody thought that this Pasquale was pretty ridiculous. So I don't think that Jim Fetzer has done himself any favors by making friends with this man and bringing him on his program and then using him as he did on his program on the 5th to talk about me, whereas he just listened to that program I did on the 3rd and then made all these comments without knowing the first thing about me. And it's like what Jim Fetzer accused me of doing, saying I just talked about this one thing that that Kevin Barrett said, and I didn't know the first thing about Jim Fetzer. I hadn't read his stuff. I hadn't listened to the programs, and I didn't know what I was talking about. Well, actually, I do know Fetzer for a long, long time. I'm very familiar with him, and I have listened to quite a few programs, a lot of them just to find out how crazy they're going to be, like when he has someone like that Greg Hallett on, and people like that, and Jim Maher, or is it Jim Mars? And now this Pasquale guy. I know something. I do know what I'm talking about. And also, I want to point out that when I do talk about people, I tell the truth. And that's part of the reason that I start getting so slow and picking my words so carefully, because I'm concerned that I want to get the right word so that I'll say it right, you know, and I won't misrepresent anything. But anyway, I need to move on here, so I will say that then Who Dares Wings wrote a comment, and it's very good, so I'm going to read it. He said, Jim Fetzer and Pasquale De Fabrizio and even Nick Kohlerstrom are Johnny Come Latelys to Holocaust revisionism. However, they have brought some new and welcome energy, which could best be used by refraining to reiterate and recycle revisionist forensic evidence and instead investigate the shadow world of the Holocaust as a psychological warfare operation that began as anti-German war propaganda and has morphed into an international civil religion with its own dogma, martyrs, shrines, etc. I think it's far more likely that the Holocaust is the basis of the Holocaust is anti-German. So I agree with that. Wings goes on to say, a key figure in pioneering this was C.D. Jackson, one of the 20th century's least known spy masters. The only extant book about him is only 112 pages and doesn't even touch on his career as Eisenhower's personal friend. Eisenhower's personal friend and intelligence advisor in World War II. Democracy and globalism, as we've come to understand it, was defined and promoted by C.D. Jackson, who was caught on film at the liberation of Buchenwald, participating in preparation of false atrocity evidence used later at the Nuremberg IMT to hang the defendants and launch the Holocaust meme. 27 years later, it was C.D. Jackson who brought the Zapruder film of the JFK assassination for life. He not brought it. He bought it for Life Incorporated to keep it out of circulation for years. And then a nice, really nice comment here, really nice, that I came upon was by 1776 Blues, who seems to be a friend of mine, although I don't know who this is. But he says, first, let's call Carolyn's lack of trust in Fetzer, Barrett, and self-admitting liar in Jude Duff justified. Carolyn is not a Johnny Come Lately. Though I appreciate most of Fetzer's work, I can't say the same about Barrett and Duff. I'll have to look at my notes to post on the why I don't regarding Barrett. My issues with Duff, though, are fresh, as if I heard them yesterday. I have never heard of Pasquale De Fabrizio, so I can't speak about him, but I will say his character assassination of Carolyn was not warranted, and absent any prior attack on him by Carolyn, may suggest he's a shill. Listen here, and he gives a link to a radio show by Mike Harris, Short End of the Stick. And Mike Harris is not such a bad guy, but he is totally associated with Gordon Duff at Veterans Today. Duff managed to recruit him too, although I think he's known him for a long time, because Mike Harris's background is in, guess what, stockbrokering, a big money, that type of international finance and so on. And now he's some kind of editor. He was the radio editor. I don't know if he still is, but if they still have radio. But he's got a program that he does. And so this guy says on 10/12/2012, last October, Gordon Duff was a guest on Mike Harris's show. Duff admitted he is Jewish. Well, that's true. He tells everybody that. He said 40% of what he writes is lies, and that Negroes and Jews were the most intelligent people on the planet, and that they were the only hope to stop World War III. That is the kind of thing that Duff says. Duff has said so many things on radio programs that people who haven't listened to that particular program have no idea that, you know, he would say such crazy things. But in another interview with Harris in January 2013, Duff says that he runs at least 62 websites and that six of these are designed to attack the others. He says it's like being in the ADL. You know, sometimes he gets on these programs and he just spouts stuff off. Maybe he's having fun. I don't know what his idea of fun is, but this guy says he also made anti-white comments. His comments led me to email Mike Harris and ask him why he continues to have Duff on, because he does have Duff very often as a guest. Harris admitted he was taken aback by Duff and couldn't explain why Duff said what he did. Well, I don't even believe that, because he has him on over and over again, and every time he's talking that badly. Well, I'm running out of time here. I hope I can get all this in. Yes, I can. I can. I will. I've got. I'm gonna. Okay, I've got a few more comments here. Anyway, he says. Two and a half years ago, Duff backed out of a scheduled interview with Carolyn after a disagreement they had on the phone. That was when I did my first show on Duff. And that's true. I were at Reason Radio, and Duff hung up after saying he would not do the interview. Basically, I explained all that, what was behind all that. And I said, basically, you could call Carolyn's criticisms about the above-mentioned Duff. Well, that's not, he says, Carolyn is no shill, nor the Jew catchphrase white supremacist. She does excellent research, so don't let her lack of command for words on her show fool you. She is blunt and will tell you what she thinks without hesitation. That was nice of him. And when I get back, I'll finish this up and we'll go on to a little more about Fetzer and then on to the Jeff Bauman.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätte und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on June 17th, yes. And the topic of my program tonight is Behind the PSYOPs, cover-up of the political agenda. Well, I haven't gotten to the real PSYOPs yet, but I am getting there. And but I am talking about trying to get across the where we see the political agenda going on everywhere. Now, I've got one more comment from the page on Jim Fetzer's radio page for the program he did on June 5th, which was in large part about me, and my program from June 3rd. So this person named Helen writes, and she's obviously someone known to Jim and who's been there, you know, who's a kind of a follower. And she says, this is ridiculous. I was expecting some reasoned and rational debate on the podcast, meaning, I think, Jim's podcast of the 5th. And while there are some interesting contributions, most of the comments are from trolls. And the biggest troll is the guy, DeFabrizio, who, guess what, is one of the speakers who is talking in the podcast. What's going on here, Jim? Could I suggest that those who appear in podcasts should be discouraged from posting their inane and asinine comments, which add nothing to the matter discussed in the podcast? I might also note that people who are in the podcast should follow your example, Jim, and refrain from commenting except on very rare occasions and only to add to the debate. Helen. Well, then Pasquale took out after Helen, too. And called her a troll and everything else and, you know, all his usual stuff. He can't help it. That's, you know, so I was, as I already said, I think that Jim hasn't done himself any favors by getting friendly with this Pasquale and acting like he's his good buddy. So from there, I told you that I was looking up Pasquale to see if he, if I could find information on him under that name, as he says there is. He's a, you know, that's his name, and he's a, I find it hard to believe that he's going around in L.A. He's born in L.A. with the name Pasquale, but anyway, he says he is. I guess he says he is. And that's when I found, I Googled Pasquale and Jim Fetzer together, and I found him on 9/11 Scholars. Forum, which is owned by James Fetzer, and that's the forum that he started after he left the one with Stephen. What's his name? The other scholars forum. He started his own with a little different name, and the last post on this forum was March 21st. So that tells you something. It's not too popular. I mean, there's not too much going on there. And what I came to was, of course, Pasquale DeFabrizio's page, his profile page. So there's a picture of him. I guess all the members have a profile page if they want to, and there's a lot of them do. And there's his picture there. My God, I already told you he looks like a convict or a mafia hitman. From there, you know, I read about whatever I could there, and from there I went to jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and there was an entry from June 7th, and it was called Boston Bombing, New Hampshire versus Jim Fetzer, and he was writing about an article that appeared May 8th, 2013, about the New Hampshire House voting to honor the Marathon bombing victims and rebuking Tremblay. Well, what happened here? They voted 312-0 to honor the Marathon bombing victims. You know, Jim Fetzer, of course, gets involved in all of these events now that are coming along so fast and furiously, and he got very involved in Sandy Hook. Of course, we know he's involved in 9/11 big time, and in my opinion, I'm going to put this here in case anybody has missed me saying it before. Jim Fetzer has been accused by many people in the 9/11 truth movement of bringing in disinformation, bringing in people like Judy Wood and others who have these unusual explanations for things that take people around in circles. And then there's also the no planes theory, which to many of the main people who have been in the 9/11 truth movement has taken people away from what would be effective in exposing this whole thing and taking them off into weird directions. And they may very well be right, because the 9/11 truth movement has gone, it's just died, it seems to me. I mean, it still goes on. They got all these things, but it's not making any, it doesn't make any progress, and I think it's been destroyed, and this is the way they destroy it. Now, this is a really important point. I cannot, go into it in any detail and say, well, this and that, but I do know that Jim Fetzer is one of the people who is accused of being involved in this, and I am very suspicious that Jim Fetzer is some kind of a disinformation agent. But I can't say that for sure. I just question it. And I said, I might, from here on, this show is going to be kind of about questioning the questioners, because you've got all these truth people, and then you have to look and see just what they're doing. So in this instance, and Fetzer joining up with veterans today is not good, because that's a site for, that's a disinfo site. See, in my opinion, that is definitely a disinfo site. I don't have any qualms at all about that. And Fetzer has just made himself right at home there. And everything he writes now goes there, and then he recommends it. Yeah, everything has got this Veterans Today at the beginning of the link. So, just about. And so, you know, he's that in itself is a problem as far as for him, as far as I'm concerned. But here we go. What took place was that in the New Hampshire House of Representatives, I guess, the state legislature, and of course there, where did this Boston was in Massachusetts. It's up in their neck of the woods, and they had a vote to honor the Boston Marathon bombing victims. And this one woman, Tremblay, she's one of the House members. She is the only person. She stood up against it, and she says that she thinks it's a hoax, or it's a staged event, or it's, you know, or it's this or that. She says it's not, it's, the same thing that that Fetzer says, basically. And of course, she was hated for the rest of them for saying that. And when they took this vote, she didn't even show up. I guess she was afraid to show up. So she didn't put her one vote against. It was 2-3, 12-0, but she did not vote for it. And, Fetzer writes, he starts out in his little article here on his website, As a former Marine Corps officer and retired professor of philosophy, and he always starts with that nowadays. You know, he always calls himself a former Marine Corps officer. And I don't remember him used to bringing that up. I remember I had known about him for quite a long time before I found out, read that he was, had his, in his past, in his youth, he was, you know, in the service and, I don't know, kind of officer reserve or something, and he was in the Marine Corps. But now he plays that up all the time. Maybe it's his connection with veterans today. Maybe that's why he thinks it shows, that's why he fits in at Veterans Today or something. But you, I see that constantly he's saying that. And then he says, basically, I have published 3 articles about the Boston bombing, including my latest, in which I honor Stella Tremblay, Man of the Year. He spells her name wrong, with an I and without the A and so on. I don't know which way is right, but I think he's got it wrong. And he calls her Man of the Year because she's got the balls that too many men don't have, and so that was his point there. And he says, the Boston bombing was an obvious staged event where some, this is Fetzer now speaking for himself, where some bystanders were injured or killed, but where the perps were not those two brothers, but members of the paramilitary company Kraft International. And then he says the older brother was taken alive but and killed while in police custody, and it reeks of fakery. And then he says, including the absence of spurting blood from Jeff Bauman's leg, the wrong color blood that was used to create false impressions. That is, you know, they say that the blood, it wasn't blood that on the sidewalks, because it was bright red and it stayed bright red. And if it was real blood, it would have turned dark red. And I believe that, too. I was surprised at seeing that bright red color in those pictures. It just doesn't even look like blood, really. But, you know, I mean, but that's just impressions I have, too. But he says a host of other subtle points. And then he says a couple more things. But he says those who are praising Bauman for his performance here have missed the boat big time. Okay, so, you know, he jumps around. He's talking about Tremblay, and he's talking about the bombing, and then he starts giving his little, you know, the evidence that really did not come from him, but it has come from other people. I mean, people started out saying these things very early on, and he's just picking it up. That's all right. I mean, you know, that's what most of us do. But when this thing about Kraft International really jumped out at me, and I thought, so he's saying he knows who carried out this whole staged Boston bombing event, that it is this paramilitary company, Kraft International, and he linked the whole thing. He linked it in his article at Veterans Today, which is where I went to see it. And so I followed the link, and it took me to a page from Andrew Winkler's The Rebel subscription news service. But the page is that Fetzer, you know, is able to let you in on it, because Fetzer must have a subscription, or maybe it's a free subscription. But anyway, you know, but normally if you go to Winkler's The Rebel and try to look up anything, you can't see it. You just see the title or something, because you're not a subscriber. You're not a member. So that's a paid subscription website. And I have a history with Andrew Winkler, too. We got into some big arguments in a discussion group. And I have a poor opinion of Andrew Winkler, so I'm not surprised that Fetzer is using that. I'm not surprised that he goes there. And so now Winkler, on his The Rebel website, has this article, and it's written by Scott Creighton, and it's from 19 April 2013. And in it, he has lots of pictures of Scott Creighton in a long article with lots and lots of those pictures, you know, where they have circles around things and arrows pointing to things. And he's trying to show that these people that were on the certain people in the crowd were members of this Craft International, whatever it is. And they were there to actually do the bombing thing. And then they, you know, they're the ones who dropped the backpacks there. And they're the ones that did this. And it's, I didn't find it very convincing. I looked at it for as long as I had time for, and I tried to, you know, follow it, but I didn't find it very convincing what they were showing. And I didn't look up Craft International. I didn't have time to do that. But I think this is all kind of strange. This has to all be looked at, but this is the information. And so I'm just saying that this is what Fetzer gives you. He gives you stuff from other people that is not all that reliable. And then he ends up all these articles, lots of his articles, he actually then adds old articles of his about this or that subject, to it. So they get very long. There's not really a whole lot to them sometimes, not a whole lot to them. And then he signs off, Jim Fetzer, a former Marine Corps officer, is McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth. You know, so to me, he may have done better in the past, but he's kind of becoming like a Gordon Duff type. And that's the last thing I've got to say about Jim Fetzer. I know I've really carried on about him quite a lot, but actually, he has been an irritant to me, not personally, but just, you know, what he does is kind of bothered me for a long time. Although there are a lot of people who think more of Fetzer than they do of Gordon, than they do of Kevin Barrett. So, well, I told you about that little trick that Barrett pulled on me to put Gordon Duff in the second hour after he had me on that one time to talk about Hitler. That shows the kind of dirty tricks that Kevin Barrett is capable of. So enough of those guys. I hope I won't, I don't know what might follow from this. And if it does and somebody tells me about it and I look at it, read it, and it starts me off again. But right now I'm going to go to Jeff Bauman. I did a few shows on Sandy Hook. I do not believe the story about Sandy Hook. I can't answer the questions, and, you know, I finally just leave it alone, because I think that what happens in a lot of these, in most of these events, and the Boston bombing included. Now, I did not really pay any attention to the that Aurora, Colorado Batman thing, so I can't speak about that. I never did go and try to look through all the stuff there. But these two, Sandy Hook and Boston, I have. And I don't believe all the stories of them. But I no longer believe that it's, I never did believe, but, you know, I read about it, that it was all, particularly this idea that it's all done in the studio, that it's all digital, it's all, it's all stuff they are able to put on TV that never actually happened, and there was nobody there and so on. But I don't believe this Jeff Bauman story. And I look at what I want to point out about this is that in every picture, well, in the first place, let me just set it up in the first place. I don't believe that the person who had his legs blown off that they call Jeff Bauman on that day in Boston is the same person who we see afterwards in the hospital and since, you know, as this Jeff Bauman. They're not the same person. I'm convinced of that. And I'm also convinced that the Bauman who is at the Boston bombing, who has the curly hair, the light brown curly hair, definitely in every picture. And when you look at all the pictures of Bauman afterwards, as I already described, he has dark hair, and it's not curly like that. It is, it has a little waviness sometimes. It's, you know, kind of silky. You know, it's not, and they certainly didn't give him a permanent wave while he was in the hospital having his legs amputated, you know, and lighten his hair color. So this has stood out to me, and I found in my last go over at Clues Forum, that it stood out to a couple other people too, which I didn't notice before. I thought, why isn't anybody talking about this? But I found that I had missed some of, you know, some of the pages, I guess, and some people had talked about it, and I want to talk about what happened to them and what they said and why it was rejected. Now, I'm using Clues Forum for this because I went there about Sandy Hook and I found, it had all these nice big photographs and, everything was, you know, everything that they talk about out there in the, you know, on all the other places, finds its way there. And, so, it, you know, you can see what's being said. And, I followed the Boston bombing thread, you know, a few times I went there and looked at everything that was on there. And, what the thing that struck me and that is this bomber. Now, I think that, he's a fake, but I think that not everybody there is a fake, and that because we see that there are people who actually are missing their parts of their legs and they've got pictures of them and they're running around. I don't think this many people, there's quite a few women, who are, and I don't think that many of them would be, you know, playing some kind of a trick by I don't know how they would show them with their legs missing or whatever. I just don't think it is, but this Bauman is, and so if you've got one person like Bauman, and what I think they've done with him is, see, they make him the star, the same way as they made a couple people the star, like that that father of the three girls, three blonde-haired girls, and the one oldest girl was killed in Sandy Hook shooting, and they made him the star, and a few other people. Some of these people, when they pick them out to make them stars, it seems. And the rest of them are just ordinary. You know, they're the ones who actually maybe really were hurt. I think these people were. But they set him up so they could make him the poster boy kind of it, and they could control it. It has to be, because I will continue here. So this is why I go to Clues Forum. And I have some criticisms, big time, of Clues Forum to add to this. So, the thread at cluesforum.info, www.cluesforum.info, is, called Alleged Explosions at Boston Marathon, April 15th, 2013. That's the title of the thread. If you go there, you have to look through there. It's under the, like, local, PSYOPs or something, and it's now got 75 pages to it. It was going real fast, but it's been going very slow the last month or so, but it's up to 75 pages, and I want to refer you to page 4 on that Clues Forum, and you can just write these page numbers down and go look at it later if you want to, you know. But best I can do, because I can't show everything in any way. So I just say on page 4 of this Alleged Explosions at Boston Marathon, the last post on the page, there's two pictures of Bauman holding his thigh with his hand. They're two different pictures. And you notice that in every picture of him on that day, he's the one who was wheeled down the street in the wheelchair, even though he had both legs missing, and they had all these people with less severe injuries on the gurneys, but he was not put on a gurney. And it is said by the skeptics that it's because he was wearing a prosthesis, at least one or two, probably, yeah, it'd have to be the whole thing, and he couldn't straighten it out. You know, his leg wouldn't straighten out because it was made that way. It was made to look the way it was, which was bent at the knee. And so he had to be in a wheelchair, which right there is not right. It doesn't make sense. But I noticed that in the picture that I put on my mailer where he's laying there, you know, on the ground and nobody's paying any attention to him, he's holding, you see his fingers, he's holding his thigh as though he's holding this thing on. And the more I look at that, you know, it just looks like a prosthesis to me. I think that's not, that, and that's why he's holding it. And when he's in the wheelchair, he's holding on to that thigh. And other pictures where he's on the ground, you don't see in many of them, you know, that part of his body. You see his face and so on. But he's always got this light brown, curly, real super curly hair. And when you do see that him, his leg, he's holding on to it. He's got his fingers around it. And I think now that it's because he's holding that prosthesis on because it goes all the way up to his hip. And what's interesting is that, well, let me just first go to page 5. If you go to the next page 5 and scroll halfway down, almost halfway down, you see a picture, in the wheelchair. Well, that's what I've already talked about. He's still holding on the thigh of the longer leg. And then on page 27, you have a GIF, a GIF of Bauman's leg falling off while being rolled down the street. Well, you don't actually see the leg falling off, but I had heard about this, and the best GIF of all, it's also on page 43 and on page 28, but the best one is on page 27. It's larger. And what it shows is that they're rolling him down the street, and then suddenly a couple of the people that are over to the side, and they're, you know, yellow, they're the first responder people, emergency people, go in front of his wheelchair, and they're moving toward the front of his wheelchair. They're stopping the wheelchair, the people who had been pushing it, and this guy bends down. A couple people are bending down, and then they get up and go on again. So I think what happened, and I've heard people say, and I didn't know what they were talking about, that when they were rolling him down the street, his prosthesis came off, and they had to put it back on. Well, this looks like when it happened. You know, you can't actually see it. But why did they stop? Why did these people go in front of it? Why did they bend down and do something? Because that, I think that's what happened. And then he had to hold on to it real tight so that it wouldn't come off after that. That's just all these things, you know. It's just like with the Elie Wiesel stuff that I'm going to talk about. They have to be, you know, you can't explain them. You don't have the actual proof there. At the same time, it doesn't make sense. And somebody needs to explain this, and they don't explain it. They don't explain it. And then on page 31, I'm going to talk about his hair now. If you scroll down almost all the way, you see a picture of Jeff Bauman holding a sign. This is before the marathon. And he's holding a sign, you know, trying to get people to go to the marathon. And he's got a couple of women there, girls next to him. And then there's the close-ups. Two close-ups of him, and you see, and he's outdoors, he's out in the sunlight, but you see how black his hair is, even out in the sunshine. And it's not kinky either. And even though in this picture he has a pretty good resemblance to the one, to the Bauman at the race, it's not the same person. And there's a lot of pictures of Jeff Bauman that are so totally unlike this person in the wheelchair and with the legs blown off that, you know, I don't believe that they're the same person. I think it's pretty clear. Now, what happened was that this poster, Anon Jed, I think there's a number involved in his name too. But on page 39, he asks whether the two men are the same. You know, he's asking that question. He doesn't think they are the same person. And on page 40, he does another post on that. He shows a bunch of photos of Jeff Bauman from Facebook, I think is what it says. And it shows the Bauman in the wheelchair, and it shows the Jeff Bauman in all these other pictures. And, you know, yeah, they resemble each other. But they're not the same person. I think that the real Jeff Bauman, or the one that's called Jeff Bauman now, I guess he's a real Jeff Bauman. He is shorter and then the other one, and the guy at the bombing site, in the wheelchair looks like a tall, lankier guy, a taller, lankier guy. And I noticed in a couple pictures that their ears are not the same. Bauman's ears are bigger compared to his face than this other guy. But just the fact that has also been brought up that this curly-haired guy at the bombing site, he's in that wheelchair being rolled along, and his eyes are open. He seems to be concentrating, and he's just trying to... I think he must have been paid an awful lot of money to do this, so he's trying to do a good job, and he's trying to, you know, but he can't just pass out because he's got to hold on to his prosthesis there. And, you know, the whole thing none of it makes any sense, and they don't have to answer any questions. You know, the thing is, they need to answer questions about this, but they don't. Well, here's what happened to this Anojed, who asked about whether didn't think these two men are the same because of the hair. And here's how they treated him on this Clues forum. It wasn't him. It wasn't Anojed. It was another guy. I keep thinking it's him. It was another guy named Gabe Locker, who was new and only had 8 posts. And he came on page 54. And he showed a lot of photos about this. And he pointed out that the hair thing, you know, the curly hair and this different color hair, he pointed that out, as I have been doing. And but he was not welcomed in this by this Brian V, who is the Philo Semite there that I call him, and a friend of Simon Shack, has a whole bunch of posts. He's kind of like a big shot there. And he responded to this Gabe Lager's post that, "Such clutter and spam. Have you nothing to bring to this discussion?" And so Gabe Lager says, "Well, thanks, Brian V. Your remarks are making me feel welcome already." And he says, "You don't think the discrepancies in Bauman's hair are important? If not, why?" Well, then he wrote another post, and he kind of... gave some excerpts from a private exchange he had with Simon Shack, and then they just tore into him. You know, basically, they didn't like it. They made him out to be something wrong with him for putting that on there. And then what happened was this Brian V. wrote and said, "I have been asked to comment on Jeff's hair. Here goes. When one is caught up in an explosion, it is customary for one's hair to actually look like an explosion, like that one might see on TV." And he then shows this strange image of an explosion that he probably made in his Photoshop or something. These guys are very talented in, photo manipulation and so on. They're way, way ahead of somebody like me in what they do and what they, you know, what they're all about. But he showed this image of an explosion that looked just like Jeff Bauman's hair, curly hair. It was even kind of a brown color. It had kind of red on the inside where the face would be. And this is on page 55. You know, so look at 54 and 55. And then they start, you know, having fun with this and calling him Jeff Bauman and, you know, B-O-M-B-M-A-N, and that he's a, you know, it's all about a bomb going off. And they showed this picture of this woman. Oh, I have that page open for myself so I can look at it. I forgot to do that. Yeah, but not that one. I have a different one. I'm looking at page, what page am I looking at? I'm looking at page 54. But on page 55 is where they have that explosion thing. And then they have a picture of this older woman in a wheelchair who's being taken to the hospital. And she has some blood on her, but she has kind of curly, frizzy hair a little bit. And they say, "Look, here's another one. Like, the explosion that she was in made her hair frizz up." And it's just ridiculous because, you know, there's all kinds of people there with straight hair. They were in the explosion. Their hair didn't frizz up. the whole thing was just entirely insane. And I thought, these people want certain stuff on their forum, and they don't want this other. They don't want, I think, the best I can come up with is that they don't want people to see Jeff Bauman as being, as this being two different people, or as this being real people. They want you to see it as photo fakery, because they say, Matt, one of the moderators, came on and said, accused this fellow of making a comparison of simulated hair. You know, that's no good. That's not helpful. Simulated hair. By that, I think they mean that these are simulated people. So their hair is simulated. Everything about them is just simulated, made digitally. They're not real. And therefore, what difference does it make what their hair is? Because the point that this guy was making, that I would make, is that this Bauman at the bombing site was a real person, and this other Bauman is a real person. But how they didn't, I'm not going to try to, you know, explain all this. Obviously, they've got two people who already were amputees, and they look a lot alike, and they got this one to play this role of the Jeff Bauman, the hero. He obviously already didn't have legs, or he wouldn't be going around now without legs. And the other guy didn't have them either, and they put these prostheses on him, and so he would play. Now, only thing I can think of is that this Jeff Bauman of today didn't want to play that role. He didn't want to do that, but he'll play the other one. I know that I don't have any answers to this, but all I can say is, from what I see, these two people are not the same, and this is enough fakery for me. And it also shows that there's something very suspicious about this Clues forum, and a lot of these people who are supposed to be showing us, you know, behind the scenes and showing us the truth and so on, are part of the game, because I do think that with these events, they want people to go down all kinds of avenues. We learned that with 9/11, and it's obviously true with the Holocaust too. They want people to go down a lot of avenues. That's why they started bringing in all these no plane theories and Judy Woods with her, you know, weapons from space and so on. And then they spend a lot of time, and then there's a lot of bickering about it. And that stops the whole thing. And because they characterize it with phrases like no plane theories and so on. And Fetzer got very involved in all of this stuff. And this Clues forum is very involved in a lot of stuff. I don't trust them either. You can find some things out there, but I don't trust these people. I don't trust. There are people I absolutely trust, but not these people. So that's what I have to say about that. I'll leave it there. There's more dispute about fakery that wasn't fake on page 50. And page 67 has some more good comparison pics on this 75-page thread. So I'll just leave you with that. I want to go on to some Elie Wiesel material. I don't know. I'll just do it as I had it here, I guess. I think I have time for it all. Oh, gosh, I better look and see. I better look at my mail, see if anybody's written anything. Paul Blake has written about Fabrizio's PI number. He says, I Googled the California PI private investigator number you mentioned on the air and immediately got Prairie View license number. I thought I heard you say you didn't find anything on air. If I'm mistaken, just ignore. No, I didn't find anything, but I didn't have the number. See, what I was saying was that when he was telling these people that if they didn't wanted to know about him from the program, they should have just Googled him to find out. That wouldn't have you wouldn't have found anything out from that. But after he gave his number, see, he gave his number in the comments section. Then if I did, I think I said, if you Googled the number, you'd maybe get this. But I didn't have the number, and nobody had the number at that time. So nobody would have been able to find out anything. That's what I was talking about. I hope that's clear. So you're right that I wasn't, I didn't have the number when I was Googling him. I just had his name. And I was just looking under private investigators. Now, somebody sent me a donation. Nice, William, again. Thank you, William. Okay, that's it for the mail questions. And I'm going to go back to SkyCon. And this, my last post at Elie Wiesel Cons the World was about trying to bring attention and make it clear to people that that I'm saying that Elie Wiesel was never in Buchenwald. I think it needs to be brought out very clearly and with some force, but it also needs to be read by enough people. I have had quite a bit of readers of it, but one person sent me a letter, okay, a comment, which I posted, but I'm going to read it here. He said, first, I agree with the other correspondents that you have done a terrific scholarly and well-documented argument. The fact that you are not receiving any factual rebuttals, that's true, belies the fact that they cannot come up with any facts as to their bare statements that lack credible citations. He says, Ellie, the museums, Ken Walzer, right. They do not come up with credible citations to back up their statements at all. So he's right. He says, second, while I have read many, many posts in the last 3 months, it seems to me that perhaps the key is finding documents about the real Lazar, the one with the accents, the real Lazar Wiesel. Well, accent or not accent, there's two different ones, but if he is from Siget, then there is not a birth certificate, a school record. Is there not a birth certificate, a school record, a deportation document, or other public document that can shed light on he and his family as to residence? Yes. Well, he's saying we need to find out something about this real Lazar Wiesel. And then that would, you know, that's what's lacking in all of this. Well, I agree with him. It is lacking. But nobody has been able to find anything. So he says, could Miklos Gruner shed some light on this subject? I posit that if the real Lazar Wiesel can be identified with more documentation than what's in the, you know, the camps, then the case for exposing Elie Wiesel's story becomes more crystallized. Well, absolutely true. Absolutely true. It would be great. My answer, and he says a little bit more there, you know, like finding out about where he went or if he died in Paris or in Brazil or on board a ship or what, you know. I mean, he's obviously read this very carefully and knows what he's talking about. And it's true. It would be great. But I say that the Lazar Wiesel of Auschwitz-Buchenwald, who is recorded as having the birth date of September 4th, 1913, has never been found by Nicholas Gruner or Miklos, or he even goes by Michael Gruner. He's never been found. Gruner looked for him, couldn't find anything about him. And Carlo Matonio kind of looked for him, couldn't find anything about him. I don't think there's too much left of that town, that's a town of Siget that they came from. And I would also say that Elie Wiesel is now a holo survivor extraordinaire, who is well known in that town, whatever, you know, it's obviously changed a lot since before the war. And Elie Wiesel being a famous person all over the world, who there would dare to question his story? They fixed up that house. It's supposed to be the house he grew up in. And, you know, it's all painted and remodeled and so on, or on the outside, they fix it up quite a bit, change some of the doors and windows and so on. But basically, you can see it's the same on the same street from older pictures. But, you know, who would even tell the truth or know much of anything? Now, I'm not going to go traveling around the world hunting for him, and I don't, maybe we should get Pasquale. Yeah, the private investigator, Pasquale, if he wants to make a big contribution to Holocaust revisionism, which he seems to want to do, along with Fetzer, that's, he should look into this and investigate who, you know, what happened to this Lazar Weasel. This would be one thing that someone like Ken Walzer will say, that, well, there is no other Lazar Weasel. There's only Ellie Weasel from Sigget, and there's nobody else. And so, you know, it has to be him. But all these people get lost. They do get lost. All kinds of people have gotten totally lost. And the fact is that these documents are very clear that this person was Lazar Weasel, and he was born in 1913. And his date didn't change. It was September 4th until it became after the liberation, this Lazar Weasel with the accents, who was born, has a different birth date. His birth date is given as October 4th, 1928, whereas Ellie Weasel's is September 30th, 1928. So because these numbers, you can think, well, you know, can be seem the same. They're not. I mean, you know, in 1928, you had all these people born who ended up in these camps and so on, because they're of that age. And, you know, you think about yourself. Let's say for me, you know, my grade, the grade that I was in with these, the kids I started with in kindergarten, they're all born the same year I was. Every one of us was born in the same year. You know, all kids all over the United States born in that year. And they, you know, they had various month and day dates for their birthday. And a lot of them were the same or close or this or that, but they're not the same person. And, there were a lot of 1928 birth dates amongst, particularly on that list of, young people from supposedly the rescued children from Buchenwald who went to France. But that doesn't mean, you know, people, kids from other, orphan kids or whatever from other places went to France too. They weren't only from Buchenwald. That was just a small part of the ones who went there from Buchenwald. That were from Buchenwald. So Ellie Weasel could have gotten into that, into those places in France and arrived there, even on the same train with, it's possible, because he was sent there too, you know, to those, he could have been staying somewhere else. He could have been in hiding. He could have been in some other camp, work camp somewhere, and gone there. But I'm going to talk now, I'll just add here, Eric Hunt is living in that part of the world now. Not right there, but, you know, he's in that part of the world. I understand he's living there. And, you know, he's always wanted to investigate Ellie, various things that he was working on. Now he's over there. But, you know, since he got such a bad feeling about Nicholas Gruner, really, really angry and not, very anti-Gruner. He doesn't want to believe anything that Gruner has said. And he basically has come out on Ellie's side, saying he believes that it was Ellie in these camps and all this is about Ellie Weasel. And so I guess he wouldn't be prepared to prove otherwise about it. And I don't think that people will find this person. He could have died. He could have been killed. He could have been blotted out some way. he could have been paid off and agreed to go and, you know, hide himself or something. I don't know. I couldn't even possibly. It's all pure speculation. But a lot of things could have happened. And so I think we have to stand on the fact that you look at the story, just like with these Boston bombings, say. You look at certain things, like with this Jeff Bauman, and you say, this doesn't add up. You know, this doesn't follow. There's things wrong here. And somebody needs to answer it and explain. But, you know, they don't. Nobody ever does. And the same with Weasel. Nobody ever does. In this case, I think that the people need to be put under oath. I mean, Ellie Weasel, Ken Walzer, any other people that need to be. They need to be put under oath and questioned and cross-examined. That's our legal process. That's the process that we have to work with. But here we come back to the power business, to the politics of it. The politics that's in control is the politics that is supporting Ellie Weasel, Ken Walzer, and all the others. So they're not. Nobody's going to do that. And Gruner tried to put Ellie Weasel on the witness stand with this case he brought in Hungary, in Budapest, and he did the best he could. I believe he worked real hard at it. I feel for the guy, even though he tells his holo lies. Still, he tried to do it. And it didn't work because the court said, you can't try this man here. You know, we don't have any jurisdiction over him. So forget it. And he couldn't do it in the United States because he doesn't have the money, or he doesn't have the ability to be here and work at it. And they wouldn't do it here either. I mean, they're not going to do it. But the information needs to come from those who know. And when a story doesn't make sense or add up, the person, if it's important, like this somebody with as much renown and fame as Ellie Weasel, well, he needs to, he's the one that needs to answer it. But the fact that he is always silent incriminates him. The fact that he refuses to ever speak about it, the fact that he refuses to show that tattoo, he says, is on his arm, incriminates him. It all incriminates him. And I don't think that there's any way that, if somebody could, I'd be all for it. But I don't think there's any way to find these other people, to find people who are going to say, oh, I'm Lazar Weasel, and, you know, or some record of them. It was a lot easier to wipe anything like that out than it has been to make Ellie Weasel's story make sense, you know. See, that's the only thing I can say to that. Now, I'm just about done here, but I was going to do another article just on the questionnaire, this Lazar Weasel questionnaire that is dated April 22nd, 1945, and another one by his friends, seems, Samuel Jacobowitz. They both filled out questionnaires, and they're both among the documents that Gruner got hold of. And the thing is that they're both said now to be Romanian, but it seems as though, whereas before Weasel was Hungarian, but it seems as though as soon as they liberated Buchenwald, they decided, you know, they took the winner's position and turned these Hungarians into Romanians if they were from the territory then. Although it wasn't the end of the war yet. So Siget was not officially in Romania yet, and yet they're already saying it was Romania on these questionnaires. And these questionnaires this was part of the U.S. Army that had liberated there, and it was in charge of everything there, and they had them fill out these forms. Of course, I made the point that Ellie Weasel, yeah, according to his book Night and his memoir, was in the hospital at this time, so he couldn't have been filling out this questionnaire. I don't know how his questionnaire is very questionable because he you know, he's using a number that had belonged until March, sometime in March, to another person who died in March. And then this number went to him. Yet he says on this questionnaire that he was in Auschwitz for 4 weeks, he was in Monowitz for 8 months, and he was in Buchenwald for 3 months. That adds up to 12 months. But it's different from this Jakubowicz, who said that he was in Auschwitz only 2 days. And Jakubowicz did come over, did go to Buchenwald on that same transport with Lazar and Abram Wiesel and Niklaus Gruner and a number of other people. Their names are on that transport list. But this particular Lazar, with the accent marks and the different birth date, was not on that transport list. But he says that he says on this questionnaire that he came from Auschwitz. But he, so this person is playing the role of Lazar Wiesel, but being a different Lazar Wiesel because he has a different birth date. And he's young again. He's, instead of being 31 or 32, he's again, 17, born in 1928. So it all becomes very complex. And that's the trouble with these things. There's a lot of complicated parts. And people have told me I should have made this article simpler even than I did. But you find, I wanted to. But I find when I start doing it that, well, I have to add this in and that in, or somebody will accuse me of not knowing it or, you know, leaving something out. And by the time you add all these things in, even if it's in footnotes, you know, it does become more complex. So, but I don't know if I have enough on these cards, these questionnaires, to do a whole article about it. I've been studying them, and they don't amount to a whole lot, except that it doesn't make much sense. So, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for listening tonight. We're in a political struggle. You know, we're in a political struggle, and we can talk about the facts of this and that, the bombings, the shootings, the Holocaust, and so on. And it's good to talk about these facts, but it's not going to change. It's not going to bring the liberation that we would hope it would. So that's it for tonight. This is Carolyn Yeager signing off for the Heretics Hour. See you next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.